Music Session number 10609, Rule 2.
This is Quail, Rule 2.
I think we all admired Stuffy, our Stuffy, enormously. We had great loyalty to him. I think you might call it affection. He built up a tremendous, well, it's an old-fashioned word, but I would say esprit de corps amongst us. And when we eventually knew that he had been treated in what we considered was a very shabby, disgraceful way, we were extremely upset about it. And the esprit de corps that he had built up was very rapidly dissipated by his successor, who was the CNC, it was Sholto Douglas then. We, rightly or wrongly, used to see Sholto around with attractive lady friends, and we felt that was completely unsuitable in a war situation.
What was Dowding's style of running the thing? Was he approachable or remote or what?
He was very remote. But if you met him in the, you know, because one did meet him occasionally in the thing, he was always very considerate, and he was a gentleman, quite frankly. I'm sure psychologists would have all sorts of words for him now, but we just thought of him as an extremely able and dedicated officer, and quite frankly, we felt he'd save Britain.
Do you have any particular memories about him? Any anecdotes?
No, I don't think I do, really. I remember his remark about the about the bag on the lady's handbag, the airwoman's handbag on the.
Can you repeat that? Because you haven't told it on the tape.
Well, in the days when we were still in civilian clothing and we hadn't perhaps got into the ways of a good airwoman, one day one airwoman committed the heinous offence of leaving her handbag on the map table. And Stuffy Dowding happened to be in, and we heard him say in a rather dry voice, "Do I see an enemy aircraft?" And she removed it in a great hurry. I don't know what there was about him, but there was something that, as I say, inspired loyalty, I think. It's the word, the only word you could use for it.
Did you feel that during the Battle of Britain he was under great pressure? Did that show?
Yes, I think it probably did. I remember he used to go awfully grey. And, I mean, after all, he had his own son in the outfit, and apart from that, I think he was very concerned for his young airmen. They weren't properly trained. The training time got less and less. I mean, after I left the ops room, I went into administration, and my first station was at Grangemouth, which was a fighter training station, and the time they spent, I mean, when they came they could hardly land their Spitfires. They were going round and round, they'd forgotten to put their wheels down, and they'd be sent round again because they'd got no radio communication, and then they landed, there were bumps and you know, they really were. They could hardly fly the things, and they weren't in the mess hardly any time before they were out and sent off down to facing the Germans, who were very skilled. I mean, the Germans had the experience of Spain and, I suppose, you know, Poland and everything. by the time I got to Grangemouth, I should think half of them were Polish. We had a Polish squadron there, and even the Poles were upset that they were sending them through so quickly. But I mean, their numbers were decimated during the Battle of Britain.
Did you yourself and those with whom you were working at Fighter Command headquarters feel that you were working through a historic occasion on which the fate of the country depended?
Oh yes, I think so. Oh yes, I'm sure, because when Germany fell, and especially when we had those manoeuvres and we knew how vulnerable we were, I mean, I think we, although there was tremendous elation, I have to tell you, there were moments of considerable, anxiety, if not fear.
Because you said earlier that the fall of France, that you felt that we were going to be defeated. How did your own attitude towards Britain's prospects change in the course of that summer? Did they go up and down, or did you gradually get more confidence?
No, I frankly think all beginning of all that time we were very concerned. I remember there was enormous elation on the 15th of September, where, of course, I mean, I now know that there were far less aircraft shot down than the thing that we thought it was, the number we were fed was double, I think, or very nearly double. There were moments of great elation. I think part of the trouble was that the administrative side was so bad. You see, none of the administrative officers had any experience at all, and no one in their senses would have had this business of none of us being able to get proper sleep. I mean, if you came off at midnight and you were going on, you had to go on at 8 o'clock next morning, you had to come off, get something to eat, get to bed, get up, get something to eat. I mean, you never had more than 5 or 6 hours in bed. And one of the things we were obviously short of was sleep. And I suspect we didn't start on a very good wicket, because all through the phony war, as I think I said, we were continuing our same social life in London, so that our sleep was minimal. And then suddenly this debacle, when France was invaded, Dunkirk fell, the manoeuvres, which, were fairly sort of undermining, and then all these air raids. There was nowhere. One of the other things that was wrong was, I know there was a naffy of some sort, but it wasn't a very welcoming place. There was absolutely nowhere for us to go off duty. Now, I was particularly lucky because one of the controllers, John Turton Jones, Wing Commander John Turton Jones, he had a very nice wife, and I must have met her on some occasion, I think probably out walking or something, and she very kindly invited Elizabeth Teese and myself round her house. And after that, we were allowed to go round there. She had a nice house and a garden and everything, and we were allowed to go round any time we liked. But most of the airwomen were living higgledy-piggledy on top of each other, so that one watch on duty and the other watch just coming off, and one not trying to sleep. And the meals, as you realise, there was breakfast, lunch and tea, and if one came off after a night's thing, one didn't necessarily want breakfast, one was thinking more of supper. but the arrangements of meals, the arrangements of sleeping were bad. Now, they did get it sorted out, particularly the meals, because of all extraordinary things. I had to go to a funeral of an aunt, nobody else could get there, the raids were bad, and I had to hitch a hike. And I, on the way back, I hitched a hike with Lord somebody, the food minister, who was the food minister, a very well-known man. And unbeknownst to me, this large car stopped, and he said, could he give me a lift? And they took me all the way to Fighter Command. And on the way, I didn't realise they were quizzing me, because I wasn't bright enough to understand. But on the way, I told him what I thought about the food. And within a day or two, there was an inspector round, and the whole thing was greatly improved.
But you felt that the difficult working conditions at Fighter Command Headquarters, that it wasn't necessary, really, if they'd have been better organised.
No, the watches could have been arranged so that to only have 8 hours off, we got to get back in the coach, get the meal, get to sleep, get up, get a meal, get the coach. It just simply didn't leave you time to get a proper sleep. And there were two nights in the week when you got very, very little sleep. And then your third, you were all on duty all night the third day, and then you were supposed to sleep in the daytime. I mean, one now knows that one's biological clock doesn't care for that sort of thing, especially when you're under stress. Practically everyone in our watch ended up with either a nervous breakdown or some sort of problem.
What problem did you get?
Well, I had insomnia, and I went out into admin. Mind you, they were very, very short of officers, and I think we were all practically given commissions and sent off, regardless of whether we were suitable or not.
So you were given a commission then, were you?
Yes. I went into admin first and given a sergeant's stripe, and I hope I sorted. In fact, I know I did. I, set to try and improve conditions.
And when once you got the commission, you became what rank?
Oh, one became the lowest sort of ASO, assistant section officer.
Did you actually have colleagues who did have nervous breakdowns then?
Yes.
Because of the pressure of work?
Yes. Well, I say, it was it was a pretty stressful time, watching these raids coming across, and they were working flat out. I think it started about July, the middle of July, if I remember rightly, right through to the end of November. I must have still been in the ops room when Stuffy was just thrown out like that, and I think that was at the. I think I'm right in saying it was about the end of November. Because I clearly remember our disapproval of his, the next number, his substitute.
What about the actual raids on the Bentley Priory area itself by the Germans? What do you remember of those?
There weren't any at all, curiously enough. Now, why not, I don't know. Of course, there were odd things coming down, but I think most of the swishing things... I mean, I was coming back from a pub, which was another alternative thing, with, I think, one of the RAF officers. There was a swishing noise, and we both threw ourselves into the gutter. I think it was a bit of aircraft, anti-aircraft, because, it was ACAC Command 2. They were next door together, which now I would question, having two strategic things like that together. But we were absolutely surrounded by ACAC batteries. It was a beautiful sight at night, it really was. All those lights going up.
Once the Blitz started on London, did you go into London itself frequently and see what was happening to the city?
No, not frequently, because, quite frankly, we were too tired. We'd learned sense by then, and we got every bit of sleep we could. Also, by then, I think the watch was much more cohesive and we did much more together. Originally, I was always with this Australian friend who, by chance, there was a two-bedroom and I just looked at her and she looked at me and we went off together and we became great friends. She, years later, had me out to Australia for 3 months while she was in Britain. She went off, got a commission before me. She came to my home and we looked after her as well as we could, and then one day an invitation came for me to go out and go round Australia with her, which my husband agreed to, and I had a marvellous and very interesting time.
But you did occasionally go to London, did you, in the Blitz?
Yes. Well, I mean, I had to go when my home was blitzed. I mean, I had to go to the mortuary and identify people, and then there were all the goods and things. So, yes, I did. Yes, we did go occasionally. I had been on the ARP, and I went back to them because they were very short-handed. Went back to them sometimes and did a bit of... I didn't do the driving because by then I was out of practice, but I sat beside them and navigated with my tin hat on and very frightened. I can remember leaning out as I left one occasion, the... whatever he called himself, the man in charge, said to me, "Don't pick up the bits," and I didn't know what he meant. When I got out, I leant out of that ambulance and I was sick as a dog. So I never went back and did that again because, you know, we had enough stress in the hole without any sort of additional stress. I mean, it's very difficult to explain to you what London was like. First of all, of course, everything was blacked out. You couldn't see. I mean, there were as many road casualties as bomb things, I would say. But when you were actually trying to find your way where you'd been sent with your ambulance, you know, every road you got to, someone would say, "Oi, there's a great crater down there, don't go there, go round somewhere else." You know, it was quite an experience. And sometimes I used to go back in the daytime when I wasn't a fighter. And... just pop into London and have a look at that sort of thing, because I mean, it didn't occur to me, I don't think it had occurred to me that London would survive at one point. All down the East End, it was absolutely chronic. And then at night, when you came back at night on the Underground, as I'm sure you know, the entire Underground, only the sort of bit near the only the sort of 18 inches or perhaps 2 feet near the rail were left, and all the rest were rows of people and with all their belongings, you know, cats and dogs and canaries, children, and they were as good tempered as it possible to be.
Was that in every Underground station?
Well, certainly every one I was in. It's something that you just, you know, it's out of this world. I mean, looking back on it. And everybody was much more friendly. I mean, you know, you would have thought nothing of leaving your bag and or your suitcase or something there. You know, nobody would have taken anything.
Because nowadays in London, people don't speak to each other. It's regarded as the rule. But would people converse with their neighbours?
Oh, yes. While you were waiting, somebody would sort of sit up in on their mattress and talk to you and oh yes, it was very friendly and very nice, completely different atmosphere to now. Yes, I popped down to London now quite a bit and I am horrified. I mean, they're the same crowds, much worse. No one could possibly only have 2 feet left now to get on those trains. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to wait, a train goes through and you can't get on and you have to wait and get pushed to the front, and then your turn comes when the second or third train arrives. It wasn't that sort of crowd, but it certainly was a crowd of people.
People say about the period of the Blitz that people were all one then, that the class differences were submerged.
Is
that true?
Absolutely. When I was in the ARP days, I used to ride a bicycle to work. My garage was below the American Ambassador's house on the edge of Kensington Park. Incidentally, we would have looked after Kensington Palace and Buckingham Palace if there'd been any trouble. And riding there, remember you had your tin hat on and your gas mask over your shoulder, and of course there were no lights. And that one day, my light had blown out on the back of my bicycle, because we still had that sort of lighting. And I looked up and there was a bus driver up above me. He said to me, "You're mighty lucky to be alive, you silly fool." And I said, "Thank you very much." Because he just hadn't seen me. He just pulled up at the last moment, which was very nice of him. Oh yes, people were. I mean, yes. And it was extremely nice.
What was the feeling towards the Germans? Was there any hatred for the people who were doing the bombing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think the Germans would have had a very difficult time if they'd really come. I mean, there was always stories that people hadn't only used their pitchforks to keep them at bay, they'd actually stuck them in them. I've no idea whether it's true. Yes. Yes, we knew hatred and fear. I mean, we were always told what would happen to us women if the Germans came. Left in no doubt. I think we kept our suitcases very ready, at the ready. You know, we had them packed in case we had to be evacuated to another ops room. And, I think we were fairly efficient over that.
So what was the morale in London like? Did the bombing make people want to give in, or did it make them more defiant?
No, they were lovely. They were lovely cockies, yes. They were very cocky, they were absolutely grand. Always laughing and talking and that sort of thing.
So people didn't say, we can't stand this, we ought to come to an agreement with Hitler?
No, and a lot of them wanted their children back. As you know, they were children right at the beginning were evacuated, then they saw the phony war, and then they found, you know, there's nothing going on, so then they had the children back. And then, of course, when it was really bad, the children were evacuated again, or most of them were.
Where did you actually see bombs drop in London yourself? Which particular streets or parts?
Now, Barts was evacuated, the surgical part, as I remember, was the operating theatres were evacuated, curiously enough, in our area, out to that same thing. But the rest of Barts was still working, and we were heading towards taking what we'd picked up. This time I was with the ambulance, and standing there, I got out, because that was my job as navigator, sort of try and find a way through. They were trying to get them to Barts, and a bomb came down then, and I sort of was knocked over. I've got two perforated eardrums from that little episode, which is probably why I'm a bit deaf.
Barts is the area of Smithfield, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, when I became an ambulance driver, you learnt London by heart. You know, you had to pass a test, like a taxi driver. And I found that, I mean, although I knew it, because in those days my memory wasn't so bad, naturally, I found it extremely difficult to find our way through to these things. I tell you, I'm no hero. I was very frightened indeed. My family lived down near Tangmere, and when I got a commission, as I tell you, I asked to be posted as far from London as possible, and found myself in up north, in my native Scotland. But my family lived near Tangmere, and when I went home, they had a dog fight overhead, and the shrapnel came down on the roof, and I found myself literally shaking. Because when we're in fight, I must say, I don't think, except, you know, when you actually heard something swishing, I don't think we had any time for that sort of physical fear. I mean, I think we had a theory that if it was intended for us, it would hit us. There was very much that feeling in the watch. We never had anyone damaged.
In the London Blitz, what did you feel about the efficiency of the emergency services, the fire brigade and so on?
Well, I imagine they were marvellous. And, I mean, a lot of air raid wardens were killed. I mean, they were most efficient when my home was blitzed, because it was a direct hit with an oil bomb. If you want real destruction, try that.
Can you tell me what an oil bomb was?
No, I've no idea, except that you can't put the fire out. There's now, or there was for the rest of the war, there was an emergency reservoir tank over it, put over it. I just simply don't know what it was, but it wasn't an ordinary, an ordinary bomb. I was told it was an oil bomb.
Did you get people in London during the Blitz complaining about the RAF or the lack of protection from the anti-aircraft guns?
No, they were tremendously proud of the effort put up. After all, we always understood that the Germans were numerically, especially their bombers, far superior to us. And as I say, they were more practiced. And of course, I suppose you'd call it a misfortune. And we had the Thames coming up, and we dreaded, at least I did, when the moon was up. You know, you always hoped there'd be a cloud cover and that they wouldn't be able to follow the... Because this is what they did. They used to follow the Thames. They could see it, a great silver ribbon below them. And they used to follow the Thames and come up, and then they dropped their bombs. TNT, mostly. I don't know when the oil bombs came in, but all I can tell you is that it raged. Very little was left. Very few of our belongings were left.
Did you use the shelters?
When we had a shelter built outside one of the... We had these executive houses requisitioned round Bentley Priory, and we certainly had a shelter in one of the gardens. And I think the orders were given that we were to use it when there was an alert. But quite frankly, it was so damp and cold. I mean, there was bad weather a lot of... I think it was in one of the months, one of the summer months. I think it was a really wet... I think it was July. And you try being down in a freshly dug... No, it was just the last thing we wanted when we were very tired. And so we just ignored the rule. And we were, you know, we all just slept like logs. At least I think we did. I chiefly remember my insomnia much later on.
You were telling me that when you went up to Grangemouth, you came into contact with quite a few of the pilots who'd flown in the Battle of Britain. Can you tell me what you observed about them and the effects that what they'd been through had had?
Yes, they... It appeared to me, who was not very observant, that they'd been under a tremendous strain. They used to get very excited. They used to drink too much. They used to have wild mess parties at night and sort of silly games, and they used to pile the chairs up literally to the ceiling, and the poor staff the next morning used to have considerable difficulties getting the chairs up down again, because they were all sort of interlocked and in a sort of thing. I remember one evening